Everybody, Jeff Dunham along with Jeff Rothpan and Matt McNeil to my right. Gentlemen, how are you this afternoon, evening, morning, whenever folks are listening? All good?
Yep, doing all well. Good.
Good. So we have a configuration differently for those who are watching. So Jeff is where he likes it. He is on top.
What?
And I mean on the video stack.
Is I mean, if I mean. Have to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just noticed something interesting. When Rothpan appeared on my computer screen, you've renamed him at the bottom. Did you do that?
Or what?
I did.
Other Jeff.
Yeah, I did it.
Other Jeff. I don't think anybody can see that where we are. I don't think
see
it. Yeah, no, they can't see it.
I'm the other one. I'm the other one now.
All right, fine.
It's fine.
And Matt, I appreciate your background there. That looks really good.
It's, yeah, that's my friend. Actually, over there is Peanut.
Yeah, it's Peanut back
there's,
there.
There's my office poster.
Okay. So for those of you who are only listening to the podcast, you got to see a little bit of the video on YouTube. Anyway, so today our podcast is going to be my interview with Adam Carolla. And for those who don't know Adam Carolla, all you got to do is Google. And, you know, gentlemen, my impression of Adam Carolla changed, as it has with a couple other guests, when I just look up their Wikipedia and Google them, because I know this much about some people, and man, that guy has had a trajectory that's just kept going.
Yeah, he's kind of like a Renaissance man, and you don't even know it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's, yeah, he has a long list that goes, and it dates way back. He's done it all from radio, and he really started the whole podcast thing way back. And
well, he's been in features. He did that movie The Hammer, and there was a stand-up movie that he did just following that one. It just blows me away, like he's been able to kind of transition from, and The Hammer's a really kind of cool little independent film. It's worth the watch. So I, you know, when I was looking into it, it was like, man, this guy has been on fire literally for the last 20 years.
Well, I always make the point of asking people, and I love this, and that's my very first podcast I talked about this. I want to talk to people about their highest point, but more is interesting about the lows when they thought, I don't know if this is going to work out. And the difference with Adam Carolla is he has so many things going at one time, unlike other people in show business or in sports or whatever other job, that most of us, if we lose our job, that's it. We don't know what the future is going to be until we find that other job. But he always has so many irons on the fire, and it doesn't matter. If something dries up, he just goes on to the next one. If the podcast dried up for him, he'd still have 10 other things to do.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah,
and what's interesting to me, too, is that it seems like somebody's trying to cancel him. And he doesn't go on an apology tour.
No, and he doesn't have to, because he doesn't have to answer to anyone. He has his own network. He has his own show. All he has to answer to is the advertisers. But if they don't like it, they'll pull, and then they're just other ones lined up. Who cares?
Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah, no, it's a really interesting ecosystem he has over there with the podcast. Because you and I have been over there. You've been on his podcast a few times.
Yeah.
And he's got a whole, like a whole little world that he's operating in.
Yeah, and it's amazing. It just keeps going, so good for him. But I do ask some interesting questions in there all about that, about how he keeps it going and all these things up in the air at the same time. And he had some great answers and ups and downs, and so we had a good chat. So you ready?
Let's do it.
There we go, folks. He's outspoken and loud, but says what he thinks. And to his legions of fans and followers, he's no BS, and he makes perfect common sense. As for his naysayers and critics, it doesn't matter, because he doesn't really care. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Adam Carolla. Adam, how are you?
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Sure. So, listen, I could go on and on about your stats and everything and all your accomplishments, but I don't think it really matters, because if people know who you are, they're watching, and if they don't know, then they're not going to watch, so it doesn't matter. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, good. So, listen, your podcast, The Adam Carolla Show, just entered its 13th year of shows. Recently recorded your 3,000th episode. I am going to tell a couple of stats here, because for the folks who are the uninitiated, it is unbelievable. Your latest book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal, Navigating Our All Woke No Joke Culture, available where all books are sold, and you're touting your live shows. Go to adamcarolla.com for all the tickets, et cetera, et cetera. So this thing's been going for 13 years. It's a talk show podcast. First episode was in February of 2009. And this is what I don't get. So the first episode was 250,000 episodes, downloads in the first 24 hours. By the third episode, it was the number one podcast on iTunes in both the U.S. and Canada. Set the Guinness record as the most downloaded podcast in 2011. During the debut week back in 2009, 1.6 million downloads. And the second week, it was 2.4 million downloads. So look, your history before the podcast goes on and on. A co-host of Loveline, co-host and creator of the Man Show, along with Jimmy Kimmel, Crank Anchors, The Apprentice, Dancing with the Stars, your car collector, car guy, all that. So what in the world launched these numbers back in 2009? And did you see that coming? I mean, it was such a new thing.
No, I didn't see it coming, but I never really saw anything coming, and I still don't. You know, I just sort of get up, go to work, have impulses. I don't say no to much. And, you know, I had a large terrestrial radio following. And when they pulled the plug on the terrestrial radio show, I think a lot of people switched over to the computer. But I also had a lot of people listening to me on the computer who weren't in markets or who were in markets that I wasn't in. So I had a sort of fan base when I switched over to podcasting.
Well, I think the obvious key to your success, to me, is that your inner voice is hooked up to your mouth. There's pretty much no filter there in a great way. And because you have the cojones to say what you think, and it's usually pretty common sense. And like I said in the introduction, the naysayers, it doesn't matter because you have your own platform, you have your own network, you have your own show. There's nobody to cancel you. And if they don't like it, they just don't listen. And if the advertisers want to go away, they do. And there's more where that came from. Have I summed that up fairly well?
Yeah, I think you have.
Okay. And so what is the, just out of curiosity, is there one tweet or one thing you said that did explode that surprised you? Or do you see these things coming?
No, I don't see anything coming. You know, someone will bring up a subject. One thing that went pretty viral was like this rant I did on it wasn't Black Lives Matter. It was Occupy Wall Street, right, which is the movement before Black Lives Matter. And I was just like, someone brought it up or something, and I just went off on it. I just, you know, said what I was thinking about it. And then a lot of people picked it up and it kind of went viral. I'm always surprised that anyone's listening. I don't know why you would pick something up. I don't know how things go viral. But there are a couple of things. That was one of them. That was one of the early ones where I sort of just went off on something. And again, I go off on things into a microphone the same way I would go off on things if you and I were just driving back from Vegas alone in a car, right, maybe in one of your Batmobiles, and somebody brought up Occupy Wall Street. That's I've always sort of subscribed to that. If this is what you're thinking, then you should say it. And that's what I've always done. And then after that, people will do with it and make with it what they will.
Well, you say what you've always done. So going back a bit, like, who were you that? I know you grew up in the Hollywood area and the Valley, so Southern California. So who were you in high school? You said that's what you've always done, but does it really go back that far? Did you get in trouble?
I didn't get into trouble. Well, I would get into trouble, but the culture was not nearly as woke, obviously, as it is now. When I was in high school, I was a jock. I went to North Hollywood High. I had a sense of humor, and I was basically the same version. I was the same person I am now, just, you know, it's 17, but I was like making jokes, busting chops, speaking my mind, always kind of trying to find interesting angles on things. Like, my feeling is I didn't really want to talk about the obvious version of whatever the subject was. I was looking more for what would be a more interesting angle on a subject. And then I was done with high school, and I was done, you know, being the class clown and being the class jock and all that stuff. And I just went onto a construction site and dug ditches.
Yeah, so you went through a litany of jobs there, and I think it's funny that both you and Howie Mandel laid carpet for a living before the comedy thing kicked in. Mm-hmm. So did you have a focus back then? Did you have any clue? And was it stand up first? How did that navigate?
My focus for the first 5 years out of high school was just pure survival. I just was trying to find a job. I would have taken a job at a supermarket or rent a car place or a travel agency. I didn't care. For 5 years, I was sort of just survival mode. Go to a construction site, clean up garbage, dig ditches, make $7 an hour, you know, buy a pickup truck, you know, get roommates, get an apartment, pay your bills, try to keep the power on.
And so many people can say that's what I did or what I'm doing. And for some people, they come to that fork in the road and either something works out or they end up going. And could you have seen yourself going another direction and still being that guy with no goals?
I didn't come from a goals-oriented family. I kind of came from a go out, get out, go find a job. You know, you're 18. You're on your own, get a job, find an apartment, you know, put gas in your truck. That was about, I was sort of on an island trying to survive at that point. So I wasn't really thinking about career goals or 401ks. I was like gathering wood and, you know, trying to fish with a spear.
So did it ever click in your mind? At what point did you go, okay, now I have a direction? Was it after some of the stand-up started working, or... At what point did it change, or has it changed? Are you the typical comedian that think, I've asked this before, that you think at some point somebody's going to figure this out and I'll be done?
I was pretty philosophical. I knew I needed to learn the skill of carpentry because I knew to get from $7 an hour to $15 an hour, I knew that meant knowing the skill of carpentry. So at the beginning stages, I was very much into, I'd take some of my paycheck and buy a tool each week. I would try to put a rack on my truck. You know, I would take weekend jobs. You know, I was very much into trying to get up to the point where I could charge $15 an hour and call myself a carpenter. Simultaneously, I had an eye toward, this can't be all there is. I mean, yeah, I knew that, it, you know, if I got to $15 an hour, it still wouldn't mean I'd be able to buy a cool car and live in a cool house. I knew that'd just be a slightly better version of what I was currently living. Like, I'd be able to have a little bigger apartment and one less roommate and, you know, eat at Sizzler every once a month instead of every 4 months, you know. So I was thinking about comedy and like ways I could get paid without being in the blue collar world.
Well, if somebody came to this country who'd never heard of you before, you've been on Dancing with the Stars, and that one cracks me up. I got to ask you about that in a minute. But what is, you know, you make fun of people with no talent. And so what is your talent? How do you, if somebody had to describe you or you had to describe yourself to somebody in just a couple of sentences, what is it that you do better than anyone?
I have a mechanical talent. I have a talent for design and, you know, architecture and building. And then I have a comedic talent, which is essentially looking at things differently than other people traditionally look at a subject.
Yeah, and obviously that's the job of a comedian, is to look at something that we all look at every single day and then to look at it from a different direction and point that out. And then to me, the biggest laughs come from people who almost get to the punchline before you do, because they realize they've thought of that but not in that way.
Right.
And you have the ability to pull that out. And I you know, one of the first times I really started paying attention to you was when you talked about how we used to say, there's Mr. So-and-so driving his Rolls Royce. He worked really hard to get there. And now it's like, look at that asshole driving his fancy car. So that had to have been one of the big ones for you, right? That rant?
Probably. I mean, I've written a few books now, maybe five books. Most of that stuff is somewhere in one of those books. And I just sort of sat around. I guess I just sit around and kind of observe society and try to make sense of it. I mean, my first book was called In 50 Years We'll All Be Chicks, and that book's like 12 years old now. But I was definitely feeling which way the wind was blowing in this society. And half the stuff I was predicting sort of came true long before 50 years.
Well, I think, you know, one of your appeals is that you just seem like it's coming off the top of your head. So what percentage of that is preparation? You know, you come in for your podcast versus you're just thinking it off. It is off the top of your head. I mean, there's got to be a lot of prep. I'm not stupid. But at the same time, you're so masterful at just chatting. So can you let us in on that?
I usually have a notepad or what I would call a buck slip, one of these little sort of cardboardy type little slips, and a pen just around. And I will just keep it near me, and I'll jot down little notes as I listen to the radio or watch TV, or even sometimes just talk to Dr. Drew on the phone. You know, just little things will jar it. And then when I come in and do the podcast, I'll have a little buck slip with a bunch of notes. Sometimes I'll look down on them and go, what was I thinking on that? I don't even know what that means. But it'll jar some sort of memory, and then I'll take off on the rant, on the impromptu version of it. And then we'll find other things as we just sort of open up and freeform it.
Right. And you've surrounded yourself with the people that enhance that and help that.
Oftentimes. Yes.
Sure. So there is a bit of an art to it. There's a discipline to it that, again, I don't think most people see, is that you have to discipline yourself to actually do that. Because, you know, they used to say, you know, keep the pad of paper by the bed. When you wake up in the middle of the night and think of something, write it down, because you'll never remember it in the morning. Is it to that point as well?
I don't keep a pad and paper by my bed. A pad and pen, I should say. I usually just, you go, I'm going to bed. I'll think about something when I get up in the morning. But I just have, you know, it was funny. I was driving in. I'll give you an example that I jotted down 3 minutes ago. I was, and again, like, this could be a routine that some other comic did 20 years ago, and I have no idea. I've just never heard it. But I was driving in to do your podcast, and I was listening to the radio, and they were talking about Trojan condoms, you know. And then I'd also heard stories about the stimulus package, and the Biden spending plan is really just a Trojan horse to sneak in a bunch of other policies. And then I thought, yeah, the Trojan horse, the concept behind the Trojan horse is we're going to use this to sneak in this other stuff. And then I thought, did Trojan condom call themselves Trojan because you're essentially trying to sneak your penis into someone's vagina? And then I thought, they must have thought that. And then I thought, no. And then I realized I had no idea. And then I thought, that's a weird comedy concept. And then I thought, someone else must have done that bit or something. And then I thought, I haven't heard it. And here we are now in real time. That's as far as I got.
Well, with that in mind, this is just the obvious question for you. And I know you've talked about it incessantly, but I want to talk about it now. Where do you think stand-up comedy's going? I mean, what's the future? It's ridiculous. I mean, even a year ago when I walked off stage, you know, that last time, back in March of last year, we saw this thing coming, and it's gotten so much worse in 12 months of what you can say and what you can't say, unless you're somebody like you and it doesn't really matter. But for somebody like me who's trying to keep fans and wants to keep selling tickets, and still would like to have some TV in the future, it is a tightrope walk at this point. So is it going to come roaring back the other direction? Where do you see the future of the stand-up? It's not fun anymore is what I'm saying.
I think what's going to happen is we keep talking about kind of uniting in this country, but it doesn't seem like we have any real intentions of doing that. And I've always said that, you know, people say to me a lot, where are we heading as a country, as a nation, you know, where as a society, where are we heading? Because they'll ask me because I've provided answers in the past and been pretty accurate. And I just say, well, in the future, there's going to be safe spaces and octagons. Half the country is going to head toward a safe space with crayons and some huggy bookies, and the other half's going into a cage fight. And, you know, I also started observing just out on the roads. I've never seen more Jeeps with Tough Mudder tires on it, or Fun and Mud tires, big knobby tires and lift kits and, you know, big suspension lifts. And I've been driving around LA. I've seen tons and tons of Jeeps. And so what I'm seeing is half the cars in LA are Priuses or Teslas, and the other half are Jeeps. So how did that phenomenon come around? Well, half went, we're getting the Tesla, and the other half said, screw that, I'm getting a Jeep. You know what I mean? We're not going to be driving Camrys any. You know what I mean? You're going to have to pick a side. You want to drive a Jeep or you want to drive a Tesla?
Well, and by the way, I do think one of my favorite things you wrote or said recently was that you think everybody should have an electric car and they should all be recharged with nuclear power. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
I think that's sure makes perfect sense. Well, as for the cancel culture, you know, as a co-creator and co-host.
Oh, well, you know what? I didn't really answer your question though. So what I'm basically saying is we're just going to create a country where if you like Marc Maron's brand of, you know, woke stand up, then you'll go watch Marc Maron. And if you enjoy Adam Carolla's brand of unwoke stand up, then you'll just go watch Adam Carolla. And I think that's where we're at. Now, Adam Carolla's not going to get network TV specials or anything like that. That's definitely true. But just sell tickets and I'll be in the Jeep group and the other guys will be in the Tesla group.
And so you don't think there's ever going to be any hand holding all come together? It'll never be what it was. It's always going to be divided.
Well, I mean, if you just kind of follow the, you know, rough estimates or the bar graph or whatever it is, you know, 4 or 5 months ago, the country basically said, if we get rid of Trump, we can come together.
Okay.
And that was kind of the sales pitch. And we got rid of Trump and we've gotten further apart.
Sure.
So I don't see any signs that we're coming together.
I've always said that the beginning of this problem came with the, and I'm sure you've said something like this as well, it's when the smartphones got, you know, everybody got one, and so everybody had a platform, and you used to be able to, you know, be upset about something and you could yell about it with your family or some close neighbors, and then that was about it. But now everybody has a platform and a say so, and they think they're important and they're not, but because they have a phone and they can make a noise, now they are.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely that. The smartphone has unleashed the hidden narcissist, which we'd had tamped down pretty well as far as the society goes, and it's just awoken the sleeping narcissist in everyone.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I have kids, little boys now, they're 5.5-year-old twins, and I don't think anything's changed. My girls are now all grown women, but they loved having their picture taken when they were little. They loved watching videos. I remember, you know, I had films of myself when I was a little kid, and for some reason, a little kid loves watching himself on whatever it is. You're fascinated with your younger self. And to me, that's where this is all gone. We've all turned into little children where we're constantly taking pictures of ourselves and constantly videotaping ourselves, and we think everyone else cares, and a handful of morons do.
Yeah, it's definitely Yeah, it is. It's brought out, the technology has brought out the childlike narcissism in everyone.
You wonder if Steve Jobs saw this coming.
I hope he didn't, but, and I assume, I don't know who could have, honestly, this thing, we're chasing this thing, you know?
Well, you got to wonder where it's going to go. I mean, you look at Star Trek, and I'm sorry about that, but I'm a geek with that. You know, they have no money, and everybody just seems goal-oriented. They never go back to the planet where people are just, you know, the ones doing, that are just the laborers. Everybody seems to have a purpose and want to expand and grow and be great. And that just seems even more of a fantasy at this point, right?
Yeah, it's also kind of the waning and maybe death of religion. You know, there used to be a higher power than you. You know, there used to be, you know, the country used to be fairly religious, and so you weren't Christ. Christ was Christ, and you'd look to something outside of you. You know, just the, by definition, religion is there's something bigger than you. You're not bigger than it is. And as religion goes away, and as the country turns a little more toward atheist and agnostic, this is bound to crop up. I would argue that probably most of this, or the lion's share of this, is coming from people that are not religious people. I'm not a religious person either. I'm just observing what's going on.
Well, I was brought up in a Christian home, and you know, you're taught that other people come first and you're second.
Right.
And you do to other people what you would like to be done back to you. And that to me is the saddest part of all this, is that we put ourselves so first and number one that it's tough to even find people that are anywhere close to that now, that are in the news. And all you hear about is the bad news. And those people, you don't hear about the good people that do that anymore. And
Well, it's the golden rule. And that's one of the things I've definitely harped on, the golden rule just sort of being lost. I mean, it's what we used to teach it. Funny, quite a long time ago. I mean, it's been 10 years, I think more. I was sitting around with my kids and the TV was on, and it was Wow Wow Wubsby, their TV show they used to watch. And they started with this song about the golden rule. And it was like, you don't have to impress people. You don't have to do this. You don't have to do that. Remember the golden rule, be yourself and you'll be cool. Everyone will love you. And I was like, that's not the golden rule. it's the opposite. So it was
the aluminum rule.
Right. It was the whole thing was about you not trying to do anything, you not having to wear fancy clothes, and you not having to act this way or that way. And you be yourself and you'll be cool. That's the golden rule. And it's like, no, that's a horrible message to send to kids. And I was kind of tapping into it. Like, why are they telling this to kids? You know, be yourself and you'll be cool. And I thought, oh, we've lost the golden rule. And kids are getting poisoned by this.
So speaking of that, I'm if you're not a religious person, you're not sending your kids to church, where does this sense of morality come from that we're supposed to teach our children? How do you teach them that lying is wrong? How do you teach them that stealing is wrong, or the Ten Commandments, or anything that Christ or whatever religious leader you want to talk about taught? And that love, so where does it's got to come from? The home. And now we're circling back to that problem. Is that where they're supposed to learn? Don't steal. Don't lie. It's all up to the parents. You'd say yes, right?
Yeah, I think you have to lead and teach by example. The kids are going to have to see you living a decent life, you know, treating people decently, taking care of them, taking care of your responsibilities, working hard.
Well, then how did you learn it? I mean, I had parents that, you know, took me to church, and I went to a Christian camp almost all my youth every summer. And so I learned a lot of those just basics of how to treat people and how to be treated, how to expect to be treated. And I learned all that from, again, from Sunday school and from going to the camp, and a little bit from my parents, of course, by example. But how did you end up figuring this out?
You know, I don't know if it's nature or nurture. I was always kind of a decent person. You know, I wouldn't lie. I wouldn't hurt anybody.
But why? Where does that come from? Why? Why do some kids lie and others don't at age 4 and 6 and 8?
I have twins as well. I have a son and a daughter. My daughter will lie and my son will not lie. And they were raised in the same place, you know.
Right.
I don't know what to chalk it up to. For me, it was always in sort of my fiber, in my being. I couldn't lie. I couldn't put my hands on somebody. I wasn't the most moral person on the planet. I had low self-esteem. I was just like, you can't lie to people. You can't hurt people. You can't take their stuff. You can't cheat. Like, that's always just sort of who I was. I didn't learn it anywhere. Where my parents weren't good parents, but they were decent people. They were like decent neighbors and things like that. You know, I didn't see them ripping people off or cheating people or screwing their business partners or doing any of that. I come from a very sort of decent group of kind of like school teachers and counselors and stuff like that. Just kind of real basic kind of liberal, just atheist people who didn't make any money and they didn't know anything about life and thought they knew things they didn't know, but they were not bad people. They would tell me, what about the other guy? How do you think they feel? How would you like it? You know, they would do the golden rule, but it was kind of a low self-esteem golden rule. there was just kind of focused on the other person.
So the low self-esteem, I'm curious about that. And I think so many comedians might have that and they don't talk about it too much. Did that go away after a certain amount of success?
Well, I would say certain amount of it superficially goes away because you are aware that you're on TV or that people stop you at the airport or that you drive a nice car, you live in a nice house. Like you know, reality on reality's terms. I knew I was successful. I knew I was talented. I knew I had abilities. So I didn't walk around feeling like an imposter, feeling like, you know, this is all going to come crashing down in 10 minutes. Like, I understood it, but in my soul, I had a kind of a low self-esteem, kind of poor person mentality. So it's like, if somebody, you know, if Letterman flew me out to do Letterman, I might be in my hotel room, I might be hungry, and someone might say, well, order room service. And I'd go, well, I'm not going to pay $27 for a hamburger. And they'd go, no, don't. You don't pay it. Have Letterman, have CBS pay for it. And I'd go, nah, I don't want to get into trouble. Man, I'll just go downstairs and find something.
See, that makes perfect sense to me. I don't think anybody taught that. It's just, you know, like you said, with twins, our boys are complete opposites in every way, and it's nothing we did. It's just in the DNA somehow.
Exactly.
So if the Man Show came along today, could you, if you didn't have to deal with advertisers and you could just do it online, could you do it again today? I mean, because it was proud of being politically incorrect, right? Is that a good way to sum it up?
Yeah, I'd say that's a good way to sum it up. It was really just Jimmy and I doing what we thought was funny, that we just wanted to do a show where we could work together and hire people we liked and sort of make each other laugh. And that was really the secret sauce of the Man Show. We just wanted to do what we wanted to do. It was we kind of, back to the Trojan horse, you know, we kind of brought it in like a Trojan horse in a Comedy Central saying, you know, here's the format. But the format was really just stuff we thought was funny.
Well, you guys obviously split politically. What happened there? I don't understand the late night guys. I really don't. The late night guys, because most of them, I don't want know one that didn't, went the left direction and started, you know, unabashedly making fun of Trump, and everybody went that direction. I don't understand when you've got this percentage of people that were either pro Trump or didn't hate him that much. Why would you want to get rid of half of that audience or a big percentage of that audience? Because you know that the other half is big enough. Is there going to be no Johnny Carson ever again, or Jay Leno, who just tries to go down the middle?
Well, now we're talking about driving the Camry versus driving the Tesla or the Jeep, right?
And so that's going to be the way it is with television. But there's, how in the world is there going to be anybody driving a Jeep with a television show?
Well, it will give birth to a lot of voices that are conservative or on the other side. And I'll give you an example. If you would have looked at the iTunes podcast charts 5 years ago and seen how many conservative podcasts there were in the top 100, there would have been one, you know, maybe two. I mean, there wasn't any. It was all left-leaning podcasts that inhabited the top of the charts on iTunes. If you take a look now, you'll see 10 or 15 where there used to be one or zero, right? So what's happening is the harder the country pulls to the left, the other folks who want to drive the Jeeps go, hey, where's our podcast? And the void is being filled now. So there shall be opportunities for folks who drive Jeeps on TV. It's just going to take Hollywood. You know, Hollywood is slow to move, and they're so far left that it's going to take a while. And they're all scared, too. So they don't want to be that first person to say, how about we get a host that drives a Jeep on our TV station?
And I understand that problem, because you have the advertisers, and they have to answer. It's all, we know this, it's all about the dollars. And so they have to answer to the consumers. They just want to sell product. And the minute they'll get canceled as well. So it's got to be a crazy difficult position to be in, to be one of those top executive guys and saying, no, I'm going to stand by this and keep my product here. And then that product will dry up, because everybody will, you know, so many people will say, nope, we're not going to take that product anymore. So what do you do? What if you're the head of some big corporation? Let's, I don't know, whatever soda, and you're stuck. We love advertising on the show. Well, we can't advertise on the show because now there's a guy on that show that did this. What do you do? Do you then boycott the show?
I think that the guys who run these, you know, big companies, they're going to have to not cave as quickly to all this stuff. You know, like recently there's the whole Georgia voting thing, and then there's Coca-Cola and there's Delta Airlines. Give it 3 days, it'll blow by.
Well, that's what I was going to say. If you just
move on.
Yeah, you just forget about it for a little while and just lay low. Something else, a bigger explosion will happen somewhere else, and everybody will look that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. So the key is, do not rush to cave and do not jump into the fray. Just run your business and give it 72 hours, and all the wokesters will be trying to cancel somebody else.
Or be like the magician and cause something somewhere else to happen, and then everybody doesn't look that direction that you don't want them to look.
Well, it coming from the mouth of a ventriloquist, I'd say.
That's right. All right, give me the high thing in your career so far where you literally went to bed going that this is that moment. Like for me, I'll give you my, of course, example was the first time I was on with Carson, and it went great. And I got over to the couch and then did some ad lib with Walter, and that was it. That was one of the moments, one of the two or three moments where I went, this is, I can't believe this. And I didn't know it until I looked back on it. So do you have a moment like that where you were really proud of what happened?
Yeah, I guess I would just boringly say, you know, the first time I did Letterman, I just crushed it. And I, you know, would watch Letterman as a young man, and I never thought in a million years I'd ever, you know, fly out to New York and do the David Letterman show. And to me, that was pretty surreal. And it happened fairly early in my career, and that was probably that moment of, my God, you just did Letterman. And the musical act, the first time I did Letterman, was James Brown.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe that James Brown was going after me, you know. And like, that's the format, the music always goes at the end, I get it, but I still was sitting there going, James Brown's going on after you.
Mine was B.B. King. It was me.
Wow.
Bob, yeah, it was me, Bob Hope, and B.B. King on a Friday night on Carson.
Wow. Was that getting right toward the end of Carson hosting?
This was in 90, April of 90. So we had two more years to go. And I was on four more times, and then started being on with Jay a few times. But yeah, that was a pretty special night. And I, you know, do you look back at that stand-up of yours and are you proud of it, or do you cringe a little bit?
I wasn't doing stand-up. I was doing panel. I was a guest.
Oh, you're doing panel. Sorry, my ignorance. So what were you talking about? You were doing panel. That's amazing. And what were you talking about then? What year was it?
I'm gonna just guess. You know, for something that was such a watershed moment, you'd think I'd know what year it was.
Yeah, I've got the 8x10 of me sitting on the couch with BB and Ed McMahon and it's all dated. You're like, I don't know, sometime I was on Letterman.
I should get a picture of that. You're right. I should get a stupid picture of me sitting there.
Of course.
With Letterman.
What year? Can you guess? And what were you doing? Why were you on?
I'll answer both those questions. I would have to Google it, but I would say 1998, 1999. I think I'd have to look. I really don't know. I'm gonna make a note.
Do you know your kid's birthday?
Well, yes, I do know my kid's birthday, but yeah. only for one reason, which is, they were supposed to be born C-section, so we had a hard date. They were supposed to be born on 666.
Oh, no. Oh, no, no, no.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell that to the counselors at your Christian camp.
The Antichrist.
January 25th, 1999. All right. So that's my assistant writing it on my screen. So, yeah, it makes sense. I said 98, 99. It was right at the beginning of 99. And the reason I was there is because I was doing Loveline and on MTV. And Loveline was a wildly popular show on MTV.
Right. And that's it?
That's enough. I mean, I think we started doing the Man Show, but the Man Show wasn't as popular, or I don't even know if it was on. But I was really there because of Loveline on MTV, which was just a crazy popular show back in the day.
So that's the high point, to being on Letterman for the first time. And how many times were you on with David? You know?
Two times.
Yeah, two times. Great.
And I did the Tonight Show a bunch of times too, and I like doing that. But for me, I was kind of watching. It wasn't with Carson, and it was with Leno, who we love. But I still grew up kind of watching Letterman.
And after that, you just I've tried to find a point in your career that was low. and then I can't do it. It just seems like you've had so many projects going and done so many things with the books and the television shows and the car thing and shows from the cars from racing. It's hard to figure out if you're at a low point, because if something was canceled and done, you just moved on, versus somebody who has a television show and it gets canceled and their life is over with until they find the next project. You always have things up in the air and going. Is that fairly accurate, and have always?
Yeah, I think it's fairly accurate. I'm kind of a train that is like speeding down a track, and I just try to stay in front of the train and throw track out. Just try to lay the track down as fast as I can. I don't really want to take my foot off the throttle and slow the train down. I want the train to keep speeding up. So you have to run out and throw out more track so you don't get derailed. And that's just basically what I've always done. Just try to stay out in front of my train and toss track down.
Yeah, and there is nobody out there like you that has had this success and consistently. And are you like Leno, where somebody says, when are you going to take a vacation? And you go, why? That's my favorite thing with Leno. He goes, I heard him say this once. He said, so you're going to take a vacation? He goes, let me get this straight. So I'm flown in a private jet somewhere. I get off that plane. I walk on stage. I tell a few stupid jokes. People laugh hilariously. They stand up and give me a standing ovation. I walk off stage. I get a giant check. And then I fly on this plane home. What part of that do I need a vacation from? Are you the same way?
Yeah, I am kind of that way. I know what it's like to work. I've done so many miserable jobs. I'm my base is very blue collar and very hands on, and I just know what it's like to crawl underneath buildings and to strip roofs and to, you know, hang drywall and work a roto hammer and all this kind of crap. I've worked so much that I never really think of what I do as work. And, you know, I understand there's obligations and there's places you have to be. And sometimes there's travel and maybe the hotel isn't the nicest, and I don't fly private very often like Jay, but by and large, coming from where I come from, you know, talking, sharing my opinions, writing a book, making a documentary, it doesn't feel like work. It doesn't feel like I need a vacation from doing stuff I want to do.
So when did the blue collar kind of work stop? When did you have to stop swinging the hammer?
It was a little bit of a transition. It was probably about a year worth where I started picking up work, working for K-Rock Radio. And I started getting little bits and pieces, you know, $50 here and $80 there.
Wait, again, forgive my ignorance. What was the stuff at K-Rock?
I was doing a character for the morning show called Mr. Burcham, the woodshop teacher.
And, that's right.
And I started to get, eventually they started to pay me like $50 a bit.
Oh, man.
And then I was doing these syndicated radio bits, selling them to radio syndicators, comedy syndicators maybe they're paying me $80 a bit or something.
As did Dan Whitney as Larry the Cable Guy, right?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So I was like doing that kind of stuff. And so I was working as a carpenter still, but I was doing things like I was building stuff for Bean of Kevin and Bean at his house. I rebuilt the studios for K-Rock when they're out in Burbank.
What?
I was doing work as a carpenter while doing work as a radio personality. And eventually I went full time. I became a full time radio show host on Loveline on K-Rock in Los Angeles. And that's when I stopped doing carpentry as a profession. I still then did it, you know, with my own homes and as a hobby and that kind of stuff. But I stopped doing it for a living.
Well, when somebody comes to one of your live shows, I'll put the plug in here. Go to adamcarolla.com. That's Carolla, Carolla.com to get the live tickets. And you're doing, what are you doing? Doing comedy clubs and theaters and what is it? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Clubs, theaters, mm-hmm. wherever. Sometimes it varies wherever I'm going.
And it, but, is it always with the podcast?
I will do a live podcast usually. Usually, there's no rules, but if I'm doing a club, the early show will be a live podcast and the late show will be stand up. And if I'm doing a theater, that'll probably just all be stand up.
So what's your show? Is it just rants? Your awesome rants, or do you have a set routine? Is it changing all the time? What?
The stand up show?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The stand up show is pretty traditional. Jokes, some rants, you know, a couple of stories, but pretty basic traditional stand up. I mean, my jokes and my point of view, but formatically not going to feel that different from watching any other stand up. The only change is usually about 45 minutes, maybe an hour in, depending on, you know, what kind of mood I am in or the audience or whatever. At some point, I'll stop doing the stand up. Like I said, yeah, about 45, 50 minutes in. And the last half hour, I'll do with something called Adam Carolla's Unprepared, where people just write one word onto a ping pong ball and we put them up into a bingo hopper and I'll pull the one ball out. And whatever the word is on the ball, I'll do a improvised stand up routine on whatever that word is.
That's pretty great. Come on, there's got to be some shills in there.
Come on. No.
Come on. No. Really?
Never. Never.
Every one of them is a real new one that night.
We hand out the balls before the show. People write one word on the ball.
Yep.
They're not allowed to write they can, but they don't write male pattern baldness on it. They just write bald. Or something. You know, you get one word, and whatever that one word is, I bring someone up from the audience. They work the hopper. They turn it around. Whatever the ball comes out, they read it. That's the bit.
That's great. And how often do you repeat markets? I mean, how many live shows a year is it? Do you know? Somebody asked me. I don't know how many I do. Do you know?
I don't know. I don't know either. You know, it's easy to do the live show, the live podcast in the same market whenever you want, because it's just always a completely different show. And then obviously doing this ping pong ball component of the stand up makes it different every time. So I get a little more leeway in coming back to the same market, if you will.
And would you rather be sitting where you are right now doing this, or do you like being on the road and doing the live show? Is that a dumb question? It's two different things, right?
No, it's a fine question. It's just like saying, you know, what do you like more, Thai food or Mexican food or Italian food? And my answer is like, which food did I eat last? And if they said, well, you had Mexican food last, I'd say, well, then let's do Thai food tonight. And they'd go, oh, you don't like Mexican food? I go, no, I love Mexican food. I had it last night. Let's do Thai. That's kind of how I am with performing versus making a documentary versus doing stand up versus doing a podcast. It's, you know,
sure.
Let's do something different than we did the day before.
And do you have an opening act, or is it just you?
It was always just me. I'd just go out and do like 100 minutes, you know, sometimes three shows a night. And at some point somebody said, you don't have to do 7 hours of stand up on a Saturday night. I mean, I literally,
right,
would do 100 minutes alone. I was like, well, how's an opener or middle or feature? Like, I didn't know any of that. Now, when I go somewhere, they'll have a local, you know, feature for 20 minutes and then I'll come out, and it just makes, you know, instead of, you know, 3 hours of comedy a night, it'll be 2.5 hours of comedy.
So we got to the high point. So again, was there ever that, again, I can't find the low point in your career. Was there any time that you said, I am done with this? There's just too many things going on. You couldn't have.
Well, doing your podcast definitely is, I don't say a low point, but if I was to create a scale between Letterman, you walked right into that, Jeff. Come on.
Of course I did.
I went and played Mansfield, Missouri college in a, like a snowstorm with eight people in the audience. And that was about 10 years ago, I remember. And I remember just standing back in the wings. You know, they had a cold pizza waiting for me. And I thought, man, this is bad. That was just a moment that I had in my head. But
that was just a bad gig. That wasn't
where... Yeah, that was just a bad gig.
That wasn't you didn't have any time where you couldn't pay the bills. Never, ever, right?
No. I just onward and upward. And some years are better than others. But I just get up and make hay while the sun shines.
I'll tell you, my equal to your college moment is I had, after my first time, that time with Carson, the next day I had to fly to a show. And I said to my agent, do I really have to go do this? And he goes, of course you do. And I'm like, because there I was on top of the world, right? I'd done Carson, and at that time, that was it, man. You'd made it if you'd did well stand up on Johnny's, right? So the next day, the next night, I flew out the next morning. I guess it was a day later. I had to go somewhere in the middle of Georgia. I love Georgia, but I was at a small college doing a nooner in a cafeteria for kids eating lunch and wandering by. And there was like one microphone and one speaker, and I'm up on stage doing my show for all the kids eating lunch. And half, you know, more than half weren't listening. And I think 10 people were listening, and I finished my thing. I was putting the dummies back in the box, and some kid came up to me and said, "Weren't you on the Tonight Show last night?" And I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Why are you here?" So, yeah, that's my story.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. All right. Is this what you want to keep doing? I mean, again, you have so many things going on, but is this something, if somebody said, "Look, Adam, this is it, and this is what you're going to be doing until you retire," are you happy with that?
No, I would always want to be doing something different than I was doing, you know, 2 years earlier, but that doesn't mean I wouldn't still be doing this.
Yeah. Well, 3,000 episodes and 13 years later, I don't think you've chosen any other thing yet.
No, this is my job, and the other stuff are kind of hobbies that I can occasionally get paid for. So I've always treated this is like broadcasting as my job, which is essentially what I've been doing for, God, 25 years,
right?
More, 30 years, getting on to, you know, 26, 28 years, something like that.
So do you and Kimmel, what's a conversation between you and Kimmel like right now?
Oh, we're good friends.
And do you just avoid subjects? You don't debate, do you?
No, we talk about life, people we know, you know, old times and that kind of stuff.
Right. So, and that's amazing to me, is that I have plenty of friends, of course, in this town, who are on the complete opposite side of where I am, but it doesn't matter. And I just wish civil people would get along and be able to sit in a room and not scream at each other like that. All right. One last question here. Any advice for the current administration?
I would say, it was nonstop talk about transparency. Maybe we ought to start thinking about all the transparency talk and implementing some of it.
But do you think Joe really has a handle on what's going on? Can he pay attention at this point, or is he being fed everything?
I think I don't think it's so much that he's along for the ride. He just is surrounded himself with people who think a certain way, and now he thinks that way as well. I don't know that he's being propped up and, you know, Susan Rice is feeding him talking points. I just think he's just going, I'm going to be the polar opposite of Donald Trump, and I've surrounded myself with a bunch of people that are thinking this super left progressive way, and I'm just going to mirror their talking points.
So what do you think is going to happen in 22?
I think there'll be a big snapback and like a big correction, and we'll want the opposite of Joe Biden, just like we wanted the opposite of Trump.
Sure. That
Biden is the opposite of Trump, and then we are, as a society, will want the opposite of Joe Biden.
It's always greener. And then in 24, same kind of continuation of 22?
Well, I don't know, because if there's a guy who gets in there or a gal who gets in there and really kicks ass and the media changes to some degree, then maybe we won't want the polar opposite. But who knows?
Yeah. All right. Well, Mr. Kroll, this has been great. We didn't chat about cars. I just I love all these other subjects, and I have such respect for your work and everything you're doing and everything you've done. It's, you know, whether you agree with you or don't agree with you, it's great to find somebody that just says what they think, and it's common sense, and it's just really refreshing. So I appreciate all you're doing out there, and looks like you're having fun with it. And you're great at it. That's the important part. So there you go.
Thanks, Jeff. We'll come by and be a guest on the podcast.
I'd love to. And by the way, I love coming and being a guest, but sometimes I don't know why I'm there.
That's the beauty of your low self-esteem.
I do. Sometimes it's like we're talking, and I'm like, I don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, then come by and just look at the cars.
Okay, I'll do that.
Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, man. See you. Well, there you go. What do you think, Bubba J?
Oh, I love Adam Corolla. Right, yeah. I don't care. Yeah. Hello, fellas.
Hey, Bubba J.
Yeah. Okay, so since we had Adam on, is that why I'm here? Is that why you picked that clip?
Yeah, we thought it was appropriate because, Matt, what Adam does a lot in his show is he'll does a lot of audience participation stuff. People ask questions. He talked about the ping pong ball thing. The what? Listen to the podcast. You'll see.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So this was a part of my last special, the Jeff Dunham last minute pandemic holiday special. Did I get that right?
Let me see. Jeff Dunham's last minute. Yeah. And
I got to read it every time.
I don't know. Yeah. Jeff Dunham's last minute pandemic. Title. Jeff Dunham's last minute. Completely unrehearsed last minute pandemic holiday That's special. It. That's it.
Hey, that was the part.
No one cares. And so this is my part. It's part of your part in that special where we went to the crowd and Bubba J just started picking on somebody all by accident. No, nothing set up. Yeah, it turned out pretty funny, huh, Matt?
You know what? I'll tell you, Bubba J, it might be my favorite part of the special.
Oh, thanks a lot. Yeah, he has a man crush on me.
Yeah, Matt always has. All right. Anyway, everybody, thanks for joining us for this podcast and enjoy Bubba J in his glory.
Yeah, in our pandemic special, and everybody had a mask on, including me. Right. Yeah. How are you guys? They're waving at me. It's good to see you. What's your first name?
Yesenia.
Yo, oh crap. Sounded more like a holiday than a name. Did you say Yesenia?
Yesenia.
What's the difference? Okay, Yesenia. That's a beautiful name. Is that name that has a certain nationality, background kind of thing?
A Mexican.
Okay, good. Yeah. So like 15 years ago, I could make some jokes. Now I'm f***ed. What do you do for a living, Yosemite? What? She's gonna blow! It wasn't a Mexican joke. No. I'm okay. All right. Can't do racist stuff. No! I can. No. Trust me, they won't realize it's you. Okay. And is this guy next to you your husband or a boyfriend or a guy with a weird name? What's your name, sir?
Chris.
Oh, thank God. That was easy. Well, Yesenia, it's very nice meeting you. You're lovely, I think. You got a mask on. I don't know, but I think you're hot. All right. Let's keep going here. Thanks for talking to us, Chris. And.
Well, that's it for this week. Be sure and join us next week for our next podcast.
Oh, is it going to be next week? It always is. Okay, good. Yeah, you can get your Apple Podcast or your favorite podcast provider. No one knows. No one cares.
Watch it on YouTube or on Facebook.
Oh, great. Yay. See it everywhere.
Yeah. Be sure and subscribe, like, and comment.
And also hit the notifications bell. And by the way, why the hell are you guys here?
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
No one knows.
We can't leave?
No one cares. Fine.
I can't hear you! Mm-hmm.